Boker Tov, everybody. Welcome to the last of our series of Halacha and Human Relations. And it's a pleasure to welcome Rabbi Feldman back. And we'll conclude our series with a shiur on Kivud Ava'im, which is always an appropriate topic anytime. Bakasha, Rabbi Feldman.
Okay, thank you so much. And yes, of course, it is always an appropriate topic anytime. I was originally inspired by the thought that this would be Erev Shavuos a week ago, which also got rearranged in light of the matzav Eretz Yisrael right now and the impact that's having all over. But we were thinking to speak about Kibud Ava'im on the eve of Shavuos because of the Asaras HaDibros calling particular attention. And the Asaras HaDibros is an important context in which to appreciate Kibud Ava'im. So to try to give a little bit of background as to how to relate to this crucial mitzvah, which is not only one of the Asaras HaDibros, but maybe is a uniquely significant mitzvah within the Asaras HaDibros. So we'll try to give a little bit of background, both conceptually and practically. But it should also note that this is a huge topic, and we could easily have had an entire series just on Kibud Ava'im. So since we're only talking about it for one year, what I'll try to do is I'm going to try to lay out some principles, and we probably should allow a little more time than usual for questions, so that can direct whatever may not be clear from the initial principles. So just to begin with, if we look at the Asaras HaDibros, so the Rishonim already note that there is something that's a little unexpected, that we have a concept that the two luchos, the two tablets, represent two different realms, that the first one represents mitzvos ben odom l'makom, the commandments that direct our behavior towards God, while the second one is about mitzvos ben odom l'chavero. It's the second one that talks about how we treat other human beings. So that being the case, it's perhaps somewhat surprising to find Kibud Ava'im, which ostensibly is about other human beings, to find that in the first group, to find that on the first tablet as mitzvah number five, as dibur number five. And this is something which the Rishonim already comment on, because this notion that there is the division between the two tablets in that way is one, it's not a recent insight. This is something that has been observed for many centuries. And in light of that, so the question comes up, why is Kibud Ava'im found in the first set and not in the second set? And it's possible that it's actually a bridge between the two, and that it contains elements of both. And this was a discussion that many Sfarim took up, how exactly to relate to this mitzvah. Is this a mitzvah that is Bein Adam L'Chavero? Or should we say that no, in its arena, it involves other human beings, but it is primarily a mitzvah Bein Adam L'Makom. So how would you understand that? We'll talk about that first because it's the less intuitive one. So how would you understand that idea that there is a mitzvah ben adam l'makom, a obligation towards God that is being fulfilled through this particular mitzvah? So one way to understand it is to say that essentially we want to acknowledge God for creating us, but God is hard to relate to. We don't interact with God on a regular basis in a way that we can point to feedback. We pray to God all the time. We believe we interact with God constantly, but we don't have the same kind of visual feedback. We don't have the same feeling of a direct interaction, while our parents are God's partners. That's a often quoted Gemara Maseches Nida. It says there are three partners in the creation of a human being, God and the two parents. So perhaps by showing a particular respect to the parents, we are showing respect to God. And that's the best way we can do it. We find his human partners and we express our deference in that way. And there's a very interesting mashal, a parable that one of the contemporary Sfarim suggested. He said, imagine the following scenario. Imagine you had a wealthy philanthropist who wanted to help out the people in the city who need to have food, who need to have meals. So he sets up a free restaurant where anyone who wants can come and will be fed and given great attention and fed in high style. And he does this for a few months and he thinks it's going well, but he wants to know, are people grateful for what he's doing? Do people appreciate this whole endeavor? And the problem is, because he's anonymous, that's how he's choosing to do it. So he's not going to have any direct feedback. No one's going to come up and thank him because he's anonymous. So he thinks of this plan. He puts cameras, hidden cameras in the restaurant. And he figures, okay, I'll look at these hidden cameras and I'll watch the people who come in and they get these meals. How do they treat the waiters? If they're nice to the waiters and they express their hakar satov, their gratitude to the people serving them directly, so then that will show that they do appreciate it. That's how I'll know. That's how I'll see that indeed they have this recognition. So the suggestion was that maybe that's what's going on here, that essentially this is about God, but you reflect your attitude towards God and his creation through the interaction with his human partners, and therefore it perhaps has a role on that first tablet as a mitzvah ben adam lemakom. Alternatively, and perhaps more intuitively, we would see it as a mitzvah ben adam lechaveru, that this is something that regulates how we treat other human beings. And in terms of understanding the nature of the mitzvah in that sense, it's not so hard to speculate what it's about. You know, presumably, it is about hakaras hatov. It is about expressing gratitude, literally the recognition of benefit, the fact that you are aware and appreciative of what has been provided for you. And therefore, as a reflection of this crucial value, some of the Rishonim explain that Hakar Satov is not just a crucial value, it's really the crucial value. It's that which gets us here in the first place. It's that which is the foundation of everything else. So Hakar Satov is so fundamental to who we are. And we express that through showing deference to our parents. And indeed, you will find in some of the Rishonim and some of the later Sfarim, this phrase that Hakar Satov is what is driving Kibud Av Ve'Im. However, what doesn't get highlighted as often, and I think it's important to appreciate, is that even Hakaras HaTov breaks down into two different types and two different aspects. And both of them seem to be present in one way or another in the conceptualizing of Kibud Av Ve'Im. That on the one hand, there is Hakaras HaTov that is essentially an interpersonal obligation, and that reflects what we would call reciprocity. So somebody who has been good to you, somebody who has provided you with benefits, so it's appropriate and correct that you should want to give that back, that you should want to reciprocate, that you should want to help out those who have helped you. So that is a ben adam lechaveru notion of hakaras hatov. But there's also another aspect of Hakaras HaTov, and if you look in some of the literature, you'll see that they're actually focusing on that aspect of it. And that is that Hakaras HaTov is a mindset, is a mentality, that we need to have an awareness of how we have benefited, and that should express itself in our attitude. But the attitude is there to show a mindset. We have a mindset of appreciation, and the attitude displays that. And that's essentially in the category of what we call midos, what we call character traits. Some have conceptualized this as a whole other realm. We call mitzvos ben adam la'atzmo, the mitzvos that we really have for our own purposes in terms of our own development and our own character. So this notion of Hakaras HaTov has an important impact in that realm as well. So essentially, the whole discussion that you find, the Sefer Menaches Chinuch was written about 150 years ago, got a lot of credit for publicizing the whole question of, is Kibud Av Aim an interpersonal mitzvah, or is it a mitzvah between man and God? So what we see here is that there are actually elements of all of them. They all relate to this concept of Hakaras HaTov, and we have Hakaras HaTov to God, and therefore we want to convey that through his human partners. We have Hakaras HaTov to our parents in the interpersonal sense of reciprocity, and that's also going to display that quality. And also the mindset of Hakaras HaTov is crucial for who we are as people. And therefore, this is the most immediate opportunity to express that, and that affects everything else. And that also makes this even more of a Shavuos topic, because in addition to the Aseres HaDibros and this taking a unique place within the Aseres HaDibros more than any other one, but there is also this element of Hakaras HaTov as being absolutely fundamental to who we are as Jews, and specifically at the time of the receiving of the Torah. We read there in Parshas Yisro that the Torah was given among great fanfare. There was great noise, kolos ubrakim, a tremendous display. And the language of the Torah there is that the Jews were told not to worry about that, that this is there l'nasos. This is there to test them, so to speak. And some explain, the Maharal, based on the Ramban, that the idea is that if the Torah is going to mean anything to us, if the greatest gift in the history of the world is going to be well distributed, so then the people who are receiving it have to have the ability to be Makir Tov. They have to be able to recognize greatness and grandeur. And if their reaction to this tremendous display is just been there, done that, okay, yeah, blah, whatever, so then the Torah is going to be wasted on them. But if they're able to recognize something great and fantastic, so then we have some potential here. So the idea that there has to be a possibility of recognizing something special is part of this mitzvah, but it's also part of everything. And that might be one additional reason, or a broad concept and constellation of reasons, why this is so fundamental and so crucial to who we are as people. And this ends up influencing a lot of the details, even though to the broader question, the issue of whether it's interpersonal or not, is not necessarily as significant as one might think, because one way or another, it certainly is a mitzvah ben adam l'chaveiro in the sense that it affects how we treat other human beings. And it certainly has its impact in the real world in that context. So it's not on the surface going to matter so much whether you categorize it one way or the other way. And now, usually when we talk about whether a mitzvah is ben adam l'makom or ben adam l'chavero, so there are two immediate ramifications of the question. And that could have been relevant here, but I'll explain that neither of them is going to be really that different in application. They both involve the same Hebrew word in different usage, and that is the word mechila. So mechila, which in some context means to be forgiven. So one impact that comes up, whether we categorize a mitzvah as ben adam l'makom or ben adam l'chaveiro, is the process of tshuva, that if one has not fulfilled a mitzvah, so one has to repent, one has to do tshuva. And the Mishnah tells us that if it is a transgression against God, so then you do tshuva between you and God. But if it's a transgression against another human being, so then you need to get their mechila, you need to get their forgiveness. So on the surface, that's one difference between the two, but it doesn't really play out as much of a practical difference. Because if one has not shown proper respect to a parent, So one way or another, they're going to have to seek forgiveness, because either it is a transgression against the parent, and therefore it's in that category where we need to seek their forgiveness, or it's a part of the tshuva process anyway, because even if we're one to conceptualize this as an aveira against God exclusively, which would be a very unusual kind of formulation, but even if one would understand it that way, certainly still the process of tshuva would require trying to address the disrespect, and therefore that would also theoretically involve a process of seeking mechila. So it's not going to practically affect things so much one way or another in terms of that issue of mechila. There's a second issue, which also involves the same Hebrew word, but in a different application. The concept of mechila in other usage also means that a person can waive their rights, W-A-I-V-E. A person can decide that if this is an interpersonal obligation, I don't insist on it. So it could theoretically have been a difference also that if this is a mitzvah ben adam lechavero, so then the parent can decide, it's okay, I don't insist on this. But if it's a mitzvah ben adam l'makom, if it's a mitzvah between man and God, so then perhaps it shouldn't be up to the parents to decide whether it's going to be extended to them or not. However, here also the practical difference is not so great, because when we look at the parameters of this mitzvah, so the Talmud tells us explicitly that a parent does have the right to be mochel. The Gemara says, av shemochel al kvodo, kvodo mochel. That a father or a mother, a parent who decides that they want to waive whatever detail of kibud av v'eim, so that they are theoretically able to do. It's an important question. If we have time, we'll try to explore to what extent is it advisable, and what exactly do we mean by that, and how far would you take that? That's all a fair question that draws on many different issues. But as a theory, the Talmud says that a parent does have the right to be mochel on their honor. So one could take this as an indication, okay, here you have a mitzvah ben adam l'chavero, so this is up to the parent to decide how to react. That shows you that it's an interpersonal mitzvah. However, it's not necessarily so conclusive either, because the nature of how the mitzvah operates is going to work this way one way or another. Because the idea of mechila in this context, as the commentaries explain, it's not really that the parent decides to remove the mitzvah of kavod. It's that they have the right to define what they care about and what they don't care about, and that all becomes a part of the mitzvah of kavod. So therefore, the notion is expressed in Hebrew as zehu kvodo, that the parent can decide, okay, this is how I define kavod for me personally, and it may be different than some of the expectations, but that's a part of the same mitzvah. So it doesn't necessarily make it any less of a God-based mitzvah, the mitzvah ben ad l'makom. The fact that the human beings have the right to define its parameters somewhat, that doesn't necessarily change the fact that it might still be an expression of a mitzvah ben adam l'makom as well. So essentially, just to recap, we're seeing here a complicated mitzvah that has many different elements to it. And just to recap what we've seen so far, it has a aspect towards God in terms of showing our acknowledgement that we're happy to be created through his human partners. It has a reciprocity element, an interpersonal element towards the parents who gave us existence in the physical sense. And it also has a character trait development component, that the notion of being able to feel and then to express gratitude is absolutely vital to every part of Judaism. And here, this is the most immediate and all-encompassing context in which that comes up, and therefore it occupies this fundamental role in our character development. And we noted that so far as practical purposes, it's not going to affect things too much, because we know that when we talk about mechila in one sense of the word, that there is a process of tshuva that would have to happen if there was a deficiency here. So in any event, that's going to require some type of apology process when possible. And time permitting, we'll talk about that important qualifier of when possible. And also the idea of mechila, that in the other usage that the parent has the right to say, I don't need this particular detail or that detail, that is still consistent with all the different categories because they do have the right to determine what constitutes kavod for their purposes. Although that's a very important question as far as the upper limit, and that's something that we'll try to clarify a little bit now. But so far, so good. Everybody with me? Okay. So what about the practicalities of Kibud Av Ve'Em? Because this is a huge issue. And of course, there are many, many complex scenarios. And you know, one session, there's only so much that we can do, but we'll try to give some basic parameters. And hopefully it'll give us somewhat of a foundation in terms of relating to this all important issue. So one thing that we know from statements in the Talmud and the Midrashim is that the basic obligation of Kibud Av Ve'Em is about service. And essentially what it refers to is the providing of service of what a parent would need. So to give food, to give drinks, to give clothing, to take care of the parent. And essentially it parallels the way that the parent takes care of the child throughout their growing up. So the same way that a parent with a young child will give them what to eat and give them what to drink and give them clothing and the like and take care of them. So too, that is how a parent, once they get a little bit older, will be treated by their children. So the foundation of Kibud Av Ve'Em is about that kind of service. We find a few other applications in the Talmud, such as the idea of referring respectfully to parents, of talking about them in a way that increases their dignity and their reputation when speaking to others, and things like that, that in general give them stature. The language of kavod really is related to the word kaved, meaning heavy, weight, that we want to give weight to the parents in terms of how they are perceived. And we find some statements in the Talmud that go to that goal as well. What is not clear from the Talmud and is the topic of major discussion among the Rishonim and has major practical relevance is there an obligation to follow a parental command? If the parent tells a child to do something, and it's not necessarily a part of service, it's not something that's going to affect their lives directly, the parents' lives directly. It's not about bring me an item or get me a cup of coffee or the like, but it's telling you, how you the child, how to run your life. Or it's something in between, something that doesn't necessarily fall into this category of service or of giving them an enhanced sense of dignity and reputation. So is there an obligation of Kibud Av Ve'Em in that context? So here, there are different positions among the Rishonim. And it's important, it's a very subtle and nuanced discussion. It's important to try to appreciate what's going on. It sounds like from many Rishonim that you don't have a clear obligation of Kibud Av Ve'Em in that sense. That's not necessarily included in the definition of what Kibud Av Ve'Em is. However, in some of the Rishonim, they say a little bit more. And I think it's important to try to appreciate that that's not the whole picture. And to give an example, while inserting another detail into the discussion. So this comes up in the Rishonim in discussing what the Talmud tells us, that a parent does not have the right to instruct a child to violate the halacha. So if a parent tells a child to eat non-kosher food or to violate the Shabbos, so then that's not included in Kibud Av Ve'Em. And the Rishonim discuss why that even needs to be taught, because some of the Rishonim say, well, of course it isn't, right? The whole discussion is premised on the assumption that you have some kind of conflict here. that you have a conflict because the Torah tells you to keep Shabbos, but your parents are telling you not to keep Shabbos. So how do you resolve the conflict? But some of the Rishonim write, that's not a conflict. That's not a part of Kibud Av Va'Em. Kibud Av Va'Em is not that they can give you instructions and you have to follow them no matter what. So there isn't really a conflict here. Why would I even think that one should violate the Shabbos? And this pushes the Rishonim to have to explain that there might be more behind the surface here, that it's not necessarily that if a parent would say, listen, I want you to violate Shabbos just because that's my whim right now. It's okay. Everyone understands that wouldn't even be included in Kibud Av Va'Em in the first place. But what if there was some kind of service that they need that involved violating Shabbos? Or what if there are other elements to consider? So the Talmud has to tell us this principle. And also some of the Rishonim have the language to say that there's no absolute obligation of Kibud Av Va'Em in that case. But there is still something. There is still an issue, and that's why we need to talk about it. So I think we can explain that through the framework that we started with, that the primary mitzvah of Kibud Av Va'Em in its most direct and intense form is the notion of reciprocity. And that most fundamentally addresses service. So when we're talking about a service for the parent, something that will actually impact on their lives, so then that's where you find Kibud Av Va'Em in the most fundamental sense. However, it's not the whole story. That there is also supposed to be a mentality of Hakaras HaTov, of gratitude, that Kibud Av Va'Em is meant to evoke. And therefore, that will have an impact on decisions, even when it's not the bottom line. So essentially, for a parent to issue an instruction that's not necessarily going to affect them, that may not constitute an absolute obligation of Kibud Av Va'Em, but it's still not nothing. It's still something, because if the response of the child is, or even if the thought of the child is, you're not the boss of me, I can do whatever I want, so then that kind of thinking is not really consistent with the mentality of Hakaras HaTov. It doesn't mean that that can always be the bottom line. There are many, many, many scenarios where a parental instruction is not going to be able to be fulfilled. And even a more absolute requirement of service is not always going to be able to be fulfilled. But it goes to the question of how it fits in with the different parts here and the mindset and what Hakaras HaTov is asking of us. So the notion of simply, yeah, you're not the boss of me, it doesn't matter, that's very hard to reconcile with a mindset of Hakaras HaTov. It may still be a highly complex issue for many, many different reasons, and it may still not be able to see itself out and how practicalities are going to happen, but the notion that there is something there is still a part of the picture. So this affects many, many things. It's also a major discussion among Chaznish and others that maybe a parental instruction has to be factored in for another reason, that Kibud Av Va'Em is not the only mitzvah in the Torah that addresses how we treat our parents. That's the formulation in the Aseret Dibros from Shavuos of Kibud Av Avicha V'Es Imecha. But there's another pasuk as well, appears in Parshas Kedoshim, Ish Imo V'Aviv Tiro, that there's an obligation of Mora Av Va'Em, that one has to also have reverence for his parents. And that's little bit difficult to define what Mora asks for. It sounds like from one passage in the Talmud that Kibud Av Va'Em is essentially about the positive things that we do in service of our parents, while Mora Av Va'Em is about the things that we don't do because they would be disrespectful. So the things that we hold back from are generally understood to be categorized by Mora Av Va'Em. But some raise the possibility that to ignore a parental request, even if the request wouldn't be of a service nature, but it's about something else, but to ignore a parental request might be a violation of Mora. So there is a discussion whether or not that's the case. But again, it's important to appreciate that that still may allow for a lot of differences in terms of practice, because Mora could also speak more to the attitude towards the request rather than whether or not there's actually compliance. So again, the same point that we said before, that to say you're not the boss of me, or to think you're not the boss of me, so that might not be compatible with an attitude of Hakaras HaTov. So one could argue that's also not compatible with an attitude of Mora, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you'll always be able to comply with a request. That if there are very significant reasons why a person cannot comply with the parental request, that doesn't automatically translate into a lack of mora. It could simply be that the other factors are going to have to play a larger role. But the notion that there's a contradiction to mora here, I think, is going to depend very much on how exactly one gets that conclusion, not necessarily only on what the conclusion is. Okay, so far so good. Everybody with me? Okay, so to say a little bit more about some of these parameters and some of the impact. So there is a very extensive discussion, as you can imagine. There are so many different nuances and complexities that can come up. So just to try to put some of them on the table, and I hope that we can say enough principles that will give some kind of clarity to the performance of this very complex mitzvah, even if we can't necessarily address every situation in all of its details. So one of the major questions that emerges from what we've just been discussing about the question of a parental request or demand or the like is, what about when there is a major impact on the child's life? So one of the most common and most significant instances of this is, what about a parent telling a child who to marry? So let's say the child who's no longer a child, the child's an adult and is interested in marrying a specific person. And the parents say, no, we don't like that one. We like that one instead. You should marry a different person. So do they have the right to do that? So here, a well-known source is the Ramah. The Ramah quotes a responsum from an earlier authority, the Maharik, that no, a parent cannot tell the child who to marry. Now, practically speaking, what that means involves many, many nuances. But what's most valuable for us in this general discussion is to consider why that is so. Why is it that despite the fact that the Torah tells us, Kaved es avicha v'yasimecha, so the default halacha here seems to be that that does not extend to telling the child who to marry. And the Maharik, the original source that the Ramah quotes, the Maharik has three different paths to explain this. And it's of value, whatever situation we're considering, because the three different paths, each of them tell us something about how this mitzvah is conceptualized. And it's also an important discussion in the later sources that the fact that the Maharik has these three reasons, so does that mean to say that you need all three reasons? What if one of them or two of them is not relevant in a given case? Would you still come to the same conclusion? Or is it only because all three reasons are there? So discussing the three reasons is very valuable for us to try to understand the parameters of how this mitzvah works. So one of the Ramah's reasons from the Maharik is essentially an extension of what we have been talking about so far, that it might simply be outside the realm of Kibud Av V'Em, that Kibud Av V'Em is about service, is about certain direct actions that a parent has the right to expect, but it's not about telling the child how to live their life. So one could argue that a direction of this nature, that this is what I think you should do in your personal decisions, is beyond the realm of what Kibud Av V'Em expects in the first place. That's the most basic of the three issues that affects this question. Another perspective that Maharik brings is fascinating for its implications in other areas, is that we established before that the parent doesn't have the right to tell the child to violate the Torah. So since getting married is a mitzvah, the parent doesn't have the right to direct the child in this area that would be going against the Torah. Now here, this is a fascinating point, because we're not necessarily saying that the parent is telling the child not to get married. The parents are telling the child, don't marry this one, marry that one instead. So why is that at all a contradiction to the Torah? So to direct them towards a different mate, that doesn't seem like that's necessarily a violation of the Torah. So what the Marik is assuming here is a fascinating idea, is that apparently that's a part of the mitzvah, that the child should be interested in marrying this specific person is a major detail of the mitzvah of getting married. So for a parent to say that, yes, I want you to fulfill the Torah's mitzvah of getting married, but with somebody who you're not so interested in, that apparently goes to the religious fulfillment of that obligation, which obviously has tremendous, tremendous nuance and detail to discuss and explore, but that itself is a fascinating presumption. The other aspect goes also to another tremendous detail in how Kibud Av V'Em is conceptualized, and I think it's also sometimes really misunderstood. So let's take a few minutes to consider this, that there is a limit on the obligation of Kibud Av V'Em that the Talmud discusses, because it poses the question that we've said at the, from the outset, that the child has to provide food and clothing and drinks and other things to the parent. Now, providing means a couple of things. So there's the physical act of bringing over the food, bringing over the garments, etc. But what about purchasing them? What about the costs that are involved in obtaining food and drink and clothing and whatever else it is? So the Talmud says, how do we look at that? Is that something that we say is Mishel Av, that the credit card, when you go to pick up the food for the parent, whose credit card do you use? Do you use the credit card of the parents, Mishel Av, or are the children paying for it, Mishel Ben? Do we say that it should be the child's credit card that pays for the food? Father says, pick me up a sandwich from that store. So are you picking it up with your credit card or with his credit card? So the conclusion of the Gemara is that it is Mishel Av, that the financial component is accountable to the parents. Kibud Av V'Em does not mean that you have to pay for the food and the clothing that you are providing to your parents. It means the physical act of providing it, but or arranging it. But it doesn't mean necessarily that you have to pay for it out of your pocket. Now, there are many important qualifications to that. And first among them, that if the parent is not able to pay for their needs and the child is, so then they're obligated because of a whole different area of halacha. They're obligated because of tzedakah. And tzedakah has a list of priorities. There's a whole hierarchy. And the first on the list of priorities in tzedakah is always one's own family. And within the list of first degree relatives, the parents certainly come highest on that list. So if the parents are not able to pay for their own food and the like, and the child is, so then for sure, because of Hilchot Tzedakah, there is an obligation to take care of that. But Kibud Av V'Em does not necessarily impose a obligation of finance on the child more than the parent. If they're both able to pay equally, so then the parents are the one who supply the funds for the children. Now, the scope of that really deserves a lot more investigation. I think it's sometimes misunderstood, that sometimes people interpret that to mean that there's no need to ever spend a nickel on Kibud Av V'Em. And this is the one mitzvah in the Torah that doesn't require you to spend anything. That if you're going to buy a lulav or an esrog or a tefillin or go to shul or get matzah for Pesach, that you understand you have to pay for. But a parent's needs, that you don't have to spend a cent on. I don't think that's what the Gemara means. I think the Gemara is saying that the nature of the mitzvah, which could involve costs, if the parents are able to do that, so then it's their costs. But it doesn't mean that it's never going to cost you anything in its normal course of events. So, for example, just to illustrate, they tell a story that somebody once asked Reb Chaim of Brisk, said that my father, I'm in Brisk and my father's in Warsaw, whatever it is, and he wants me to visit him, but the train costs money. So I'm thinking, this guy's is Lamdin, I'm thinking I don't have to go visit my father because the train costs money, and Kibbutz is Mishalav. It's not Mishal Ben. I don't have to spend money on Kibbutz. To which Reb Chaim responded to him. He said, you're right. You don't have to spend money. So walk to Warsaw. And it was a sharp response, but I think the point was, I don't even really need that. The point is that we don't mean that there's never going to be any expenses. Certainly the basic expenses of doing what it takes to serve the parents are no less worthy than the cost of a lulav or a matzah. It means that this idea of service is something which doesn't necessarily imply that there is a bill that goes to the kids for the food and the clothing. But if there are other costs, there could be. But nonetheless, more broadly interpreted, you do find that it's understood that if there is a major impact on the ability of a child to spend what they need and the like, so then Kibbutz Av Ve'Em is limited. So many poskim understand that it's not just financial, but anything that's going to have its impact primarily on the children is not included on Kibbutz Av Ve'Em. So when it comes to marriage, say Ein Lecha Mishal Ben Gadol Mizeh, right? There's nothing that's going to have a bigger impact on the child's life than telling them on who they can and who they can't marry. So therefore, for that reason, it's certainly a much bigger imposition than telling them that they would have to pay for the dinner or pay for the clothing. Telling them who they can or can't marry certainly is a much greater impact than that. So essentially, a kal v'chomer from that limitation, it should apply in that context as well. So what's important to appreciate is that there are many, many nuances here, as perhaps you can see, that each one of those three factors is given to a lot of possible detail. So, for example, the first issue of it doesn't affect the parent's life, who the child marries, clearly that's not the whole story. Very often a parent is very much affected by the choice of a child to marry one person or another, certainly in one part of the world or another, and it certainly could impact on the ability of the child to do the more fundamental aspects of Kibbutz Av Ve'Em. So there's a great variable there. Certainly also the question of to what extent it impacts on the child's religious fulfillments and obligations is also very subjective and very variable. And this third element as well, the whole question of how much of an impact does it have on the child's life, all of these details really are subject to much variability. So no one would say that the story is completely settled by mentioning these points, but each of them gives us a little bit more context to how this picture is assessed and how to address it. And I will say, as a matter of practicality, there's a lot of back and forth about this. You know, here the Rama quotes the Ma'arik that it's not the parent's decision. And there are many qualifying statements in later Svarim, depending on what and how and where and why. And the Chazon Ish had a lot to say about this. And what I would say, as a matter of practicality, that when and if such situations come up, and of course they do, this is a very practical, relevant issue. So when there is a difference of perspective between a parent and a child in the issue of the child's marriage, so the way to address it is not to open up the Shulchan Aruch and say, oh, I got this Rama, well, I got this Chazon Ish, well, I got this. That's never going to work in terms of anybody's long-term happiness. That, yes, this is reflecting some of the default halacha and some of the principles that go into the discussion, but that's never going to be the way to address it practically. That for either the parent or the child to say, oh, here the Rama is like me, the Chazon Ish is like me, the Bach is like me, that's just not going to lead to anyone's happiness. And that when these situations come up, sometimes there's a need to go to a third party who is wise and understanding and can be helpful in the discussion. And ideally, there can be some kind of a understanding between the parent and the child and whatever will be most conducive to the future happiness of all parties. But to point to one source or another and use that to try to settle the discussion is certainly not going to be a recipe for happiness in this uniquely significant area of life. And when one considers the question also of a child making aliyah and the parent not wanting that, so there are many overlapping issues with the marriage discussion, as you can assume, and that also involves a lot of the same factors, and that's also perhaps equally complex kind of discussion. It should also, can't do justice to these very weighty topics in such a brief time, but just make reference to the fact that there's no question that very often there can be a highly complex relationship between a parent and a child for reasons that are very real. Certainly if a parent is abusive, and further than that, also has demands on the child that are not consistent with the child's very basic mental or emotional needs. So that is an area in which there is much complexity. And just to say a word or two about how this plays out. So first of all, in the scenario, if a parent was literally evil, however you wanted to determine that, so then there is a whole discussion whether kibud av v'em applies or not. I don't want to be too facile about that discussion because there's a lot of nuance to it. There are some who maintain that there's no obligation of kibud av v'em if a parent is evil. However, there's a lot of nuances there as well. First of all, it's not so clear that that's the whole story, especially in light of some of the factors that we have mentioned. But also, how do you define evil can be a hugely subjective question. And to what extent are we focusing on mitzvos ben adam l'makom, mitzvos ben adam l'chavero? What exactly are we talking about? There is a lot of subjectivity in that definition. And there's a lot of nuance. So I would be hesitant to put too much weight on that one factor, but it is something that does play a role and is something that is a part of the discussion. But it's also important to appreciate that everything that we've said so far about there being limits on kibud av v'em is probably more significant than the other aspect. The question of assessing the moral worthiness of a parent can really provoke many complexities and many subjective assessments that have implications in many different directions. But in terms of what practically is being asked of a child, so there are many reasons why it might be limited along the lines that we've seen so far. So if the service for the child, or if listening to the requests of the parent, are going to either have a harmful effect on the mental health of the child, or are going to impose on their lives emotionally, practically, or in any other way, in such a way that makes it impossible for them to attend to their own basic needs. So already that has a very limiting effect on where kibud av v'em can go. So here again, you're dealing with tremendously weighty issues that have implications in the real world in many different directions, and that has to be acknowledged. But a large part of it is going to draw upon a lot of what we've seen so far, and every situation is different, and every case is going to require some careful attention. And sometimes it means separation. Sometimes it means, and this we find even in the instances that don't necessarily have the same history behind them, but the Talmud says, kind of describes cases where the best way for a child to be respectful to a parent was to not be in their presence and not be put into a situation where they're not confident they will be able to act respectfully. And sometimes that's the necessary path. And that might be true for reasons about medical conditions, whether physical or mental, may not have anything to do with the moral character of the parents, maybe issues that are completely out of their control. But functionally speaking, at this point in time, it's very difficult for the child to be able to relate to the parent in a respectful way. And it does sometimes mean that limiting or eliminating the interaction between them might be the most respectful route. So again, I'll try to take some questions now, and we only have a few minutes left. I hope that what we've said so far gives some principles just to understand. Again, a lot of situations really require careful guidance and analysis because there's so much complexity in this area. But I hope that what we've said so far gives some principles, some basic parameters to work with as far as understanding what some of the issues could be. Rabbi Kelman, do you want to...
Okay, thank you. No, okay, if anybody has any questions, I see one question in the chat box about sort of what you were just talking about at the end. If I guess a reverse kibbutz of aim is one way of honoring parents, being grateful to them for showing you how not to behave.
Well, it's a little cynically phrased, but there are, if you break that down into a few parts, there are elements of that. So, you know, it's interesting. There's a lot more in that question than one might think, because there's a lot to consider. So first of all, it is true that for a child to behave properly is an honor to the parents objectively, regardless of whether this was the behavior that the parents modeled or not. So that itself, even beyond its own value, should always act properly in all ways. But doing so is a act that brings kavod, whether it's what you're trying to do or not, but that is something that is held up as a primary example. It's interesting to note that the whole idea of reciting Kaddish, which is a later development, but is one that is very closely intertwined with the whole idea of Kibbutz Av Ve'Em, is really about that the notion of Kaddish, which so many of us understandably take so seriously as a function of Kibbutz Av Ve'Em, is really, if you look at the words, there isn't anything in the Kaddish recitation about the parents. Essentially what it is a declaration of faith by the child and the assumption that this public declaration of faith is a credit to the parents. And that's where the whole benefit comes from. So there is that ever-present idea that behaving in a proper way and in a way that honors God and society is a honor to the parents, regardless of how the parents themselves actually behaved. So certainly that part is true as well. And the notion of Hakaras HaTov can come from many different directions. So sometimes in terms of one's internal sense of Hakaras HaTov, sometimes it is true that that can happen because there's direct gratitude for something. And sometimes it comes about indirectly that you are happy that you had a certain benefit in your life, even if it came about in an unusual kind of way. So there is that element as well. It would always be preferable if that could be done with charity, that if a person can think, okay, I learned from the parent how not to behave, but the parent's behavior was excusable for whatever reason, but I still see how it played out. And if one can be charitable in terms of how they assess their parents while still maybe learning what not to do, there's probably a lot more value to that as far as one's mindset. And all of that goes to the equation, but it's also true, just to add one other element, that when we're talking about issues of genuine propriety and real rectitude, so then one wants to do that regardless of how the parents behave. But there's also a sensitivity sometimes in the other direction, that one doesn't want to behave in a way that implies criticism to the parents that is not justified, when it's a matter of lesser consequence. And a person is going to take on a practice that's going to make the parents look somehow negative in comparison, in a lesser way, in a way that's not so significant, but just going to have a negative effect on how the parents are perceived. There's a justified concern to be careful of that as well. We say in general that certain things we do, shlo lahotzi laza rishonim, that we don't want to imply that we think that we are more worthy or more pious than the earlier generations, when it's not necessarily the case. And that's all the more so true about parents. One has to be very careful also about not creating that impression. So I don't know if that was a complicated enough answer.
Yeah, you know, that's fine. I don't know if anybody wants to orally ask a question, you can unmute themselves.
I see a question here that was posted. I think it's a fascinating question, actually, and I have a perspective on that question, which I'll try to address for a second. So here, the question specifically about Kaddish, but it actually comes up with a lot of other issues. So I'm going to expand a little bit. The questioner is phrased, can a parent be mochel, they're covered with respect to saying Kaddish for them for 1 month instead of 11 months? So Kaddish, like we said, has its own parameters, and it's a little bit complex because of the picture that you're creating. But let's just try to explore this issue a little bit. That this may take an extra minute. Is it okay if we go over time for a minute or two?
Yeah.
Because there's a lot to unpack about this question. So when it comes to avelus, so we know that Rachman al-Islan, if somebody loses a relative, so normally avelus goes for a month, but for a parent it goes for 12 months. And we say Kaddish for 1 month less, it's got its own considerations, but normally avelus goes for 12 months, and it's a highly complicated thing because the idea of a 12-month avelus often ends up creating challenges in life, because normally avelus involves not going to parties such as weddings and the like. This is where the issue comes up most often, and weddings and other types of important family events, and that often creates a lot of conflict for a child to not be able to attend weddings, which might be important family events or otherwise during this year. Is a significant challenge for a lot of people. And the question comes up, so is this something that the parent can decide, listen, I don't want this, I don't need this, that you shouldn't be able to go to weddings for a year. It's not something that I want as far as how I should be treated. So this is an extensive discussion, and I'll tell you how I relate to it, which is not necessarily what you find at other svarim, but I'll tell you the way I think this issue could be considered. So strictly speaking, there are many who feel that a parent can be mochel on this, that the idea of a year of avelus as opposed to just a month is a function of kibbut aveim. And as we've seen, av shemochel kvodo kvodo mochel, a parent does have the right to be mochel on their kavod and to define how it should play out. So it sounds like if you do the math, if you do the parts together, that that's included, that a parent can say, listen, after I die, I don't want you to observe a year of avelus. I don't want you to stay away from the weddings of people who are important to you, and you don't have to follow that. So strictly speaking, it sounds like that should be possible. And many did take that position. So a couple of questions. So first of all, how come you hear about this so rarely? And how come it's so uncommon to see this happening? It's very common. I can certainly tell you as a congregational rabbi how many questions I get about, can I go to this wedding? Can I go to this event? What about under these circumstances? It's a very, very, very common question. It's a very common conflict in many people's lives. So how come you don't see more of this? How come you don't see a parent saying that I don't want you to observe a year of avelus for me with all of that complexity? That's one question. I will tell you parenthetically that one person who did do this, Reshechter Shlita, his father did tell him he was mochel on avelus, but Reshechter very rarely ever acted on that because he felt it would be so surprising to anyone that have to explain the whole story. So in practice, he didn't necessarily live his life differently than he would have been expected to, but he did believe that in theory it was effective, that and that the parent deciding to be mochel on the avelus is a possibility. And I asked Rav Asher Weiss once about this, about the question of if one assumes that mechila is possible, so what about presumed mechila and what about partial mechila? So does it mean that the parent actually has to spell this out? Or what happens if a parent passes away and 6 months later there's an important wedding in the family that a lot of emotions are connected to and everyone's having a hard time? And the child can say with confidence, my mother never would have wanted this. She wouldn't have wanted that I should be held back from attending this event in this difficult time. A partial assumption, say, okay, for the rest of the 11 and a half months, I'm going to stay away from any unnecessary parties. I'm certainly not going to ignore the whole avelus, but this one event over the course of the year that has so much challenge that they wouldn't want me to miss, so that I'm going to go to. So does the child have the right to assume mechila under those circumstances? And I asked Rav Asher Weiss this, and he thought that theoretically the answer should be yes, because when mechila does work, It also works when there is a clear assumption, a clear basis to assume that Mechila definitely would have been there. So theoretically, it should work. But he wouldn't recommend it because you can see the danger that once you start going down that path, so then the whole concept falls apart, that everyone can then just decide, well, they wouldn't have wanted this. They wouldn't want me not to have a new dress for Yontif. They wouldn't have want me to miss out on this birthday party. And the whole thing essentially falls apart. So to act on that theoretical truth, didn't think was wise. But nonetheless, with all this, again, the basic question, how come you see this so rarely? How come it's so uncommon to have a situation where a parent is mochel and the child then just decides to go to whatever weddings they want to go to because the parent is mochel? So I think the reason is that the notion of kavod changes at this point. And that the idea of kavod for a parent who's no longer alive, so that is explicit in the Talmud, mechab de mechayiv, mechab de moso, that there's obligation to a parent when they're alive, there's obligation after they're no longer alive. And yes, kaddish, like we said, is also connected to that notion of kavod and the like. However, while it's true that there is kavod for a parent that no longer is alive, I think the parameters are different. That there's a different kind of concept that is at play here. That the notion of kavod for a parent who is alive is primarily about service, is primarily about doing things that make them happy. So whether that's literal service or whether that's other things, but things that make them feel pleasure. So that's what we mean by kavod towards a parent that's alive. When a parent is no longer alive and they're not seeing what's going on, they're not feeling happy because of how they're being treated. So the aspect of kibud av v'aim that continues to pertain is different. And this is how Rabbi Akiva Eiger and anybody or and others explain that it takes on a different nature. It's no longer about doing things that they are happy about. It's about bringing honor to their name. It's about doing things that show how important they were and how much they mean to you. So to name yeshiva after a parent, to give tzedakah, to do other things that bring credit to the parents, that's really what we talk about when we say that kibud av v'aim applies after the parent is no longer alive. So the notion of abstaining from celebrations during the year of Avelis is a way of saying that the parent was important and makes a big difference in your life. And during this time, when the loss is fresh, you can't go on as normal. You can't be celebrating and you can't be having a good time as if the parents never meant anything, so to speak. So it's a statement of the impact the parents had on the life of the child to abstain from these public celebrations. So the notion of mechila by kibud av v'aim, as we explained in the beginning, that really works much better with the type of kibud av v'aim we're talking about during a lifetime. That a parent, you're supposed to make them happy. So they have the right to say, this is what I care about, this is what I don't care about. Zehu kvodo. So this is something that is subject to kibud av v'aim and this isn't. So the notion of mechila really fits much better towards the kibud av v'aim that we're talking about during the lifetime of a parent. When you're talking about the kibud av v'aim to a deceased parent, it's of a different type. And even though theoretically it all uses the same language, but the notion of mechila is a much less comfortable fit. So the idea that we're trying to show the world that the loss is significant and that we care about the parents and that it made a difference in our life. So the fact that they may not insist on that has much less relevance. It still doesn't change the fact that it still undermines the message that we're sending to the world. So mechila has much less of a role and maybe less of a propriety. And like we discussed at the beginning, that the fact that a parent can be mochel is not identical with the question of whether a parent should be mochel and what is the implication and the consequence of a parent being mochel. So I think that that's, if I could explain the minig olam, I think that that's a big part of it, that the kinds of things a parent may not insist on in their lifetime, okay, they can be mochel, they can decide what they care about. But the practice of Avelos, of Yud Beis Chodesh, is something that makes a public statement of the significance of the loss of the parent. And even if the parent doesn't want that, it doesn't change the fact that not complying with this is going to make a public statement, which is maybe not in the interest of what Klal Yisrael is looking for. So I suspect that that is why it's not something that you see so often, despite the fact that theoretically there's a space for it.
Rabbi, okay, very nice, very good. I would might argue the reason you don't see very much about it is because people are totally unaware of it. It comes as a shock to people to hear
right,
that.
Right, but we could easily make people aware of it, you know, especially because there's this whole history.
Today, I'm sure you know that in the last issue of in Chakira, Shlomo Brody wrote a fascinating article that I just read a couple of weeks ago. Mark Shapiro pointed out the article, on our Monday night class, and he who knows a lot told me he was really unaware of the whole thing that it went on. And Rabbi Brody, who runs the Tikva Fund, I believe he taught in Yeshivat HaKotel for many years. He wrote an article on Halakha in Jerusalem Post. For those who don't know who he is, has this fascinating book, Halakha and Complexity, complex issues in Halakha. I don't remember the exact title of the book.
A guide to the complex.
A Guide to the Complex. Thank you very much. So on all modern halakhic issues. So his father, who was also, a learned father, doctor in Houston, Texas, for many years. And his father instructed him and his brothers not to mourn for the year,
yeah,
for the weddings. And he told them five times and he put it in writing. Absolutely. I want you to go to a wedding. So he was shocked by the request and he wrote a whole article. And the article is really, this is absolutely 100% fine and legitimate. And he quoted Rav Schachter and Rav Huttner, the same thing, told his father about this. And I imagine among Talmidei Chachamim who know about it, it's more common. But I think the average person, it's just so, it's perhaps what you say, the kavod of the year, people have to express it in a way. But you're 100% right. The idea of not going to weddings, which anyways is a machloket in the Rishonim, if that's included in available. Today, we accept the notion it is. But as, of course, many Rishonim did not feel that way. So I just find this fascinating. And I actually wonder in today's world, is that article even going to have an impact? And people are going to maybe be taking up on the issue. I mean, I think your analysis is also very good, but I think it's also, I don't want to call it amaratsut, but it's, people are just not aware of that option. And I think people would say, don't go to movies, don't go to a baseball game, but to go to your best friend's wedding, the parents would want the kid to go to the best friend's wedding.
So aware of all that, I'm still going to stick with my position because I still think that's true, that to explain the minhag olam, that it's not simply ignorance, because this is such an issue that creates such conflict in people's lives. It could easily be publicized. And the fact that there isn't more of an effort, being the Bashach wrote about this a long time ago, this is not a new point. And the fact that all of our lifetimes and our parents' lifetimes and grandparents' lifetimes have all gone past without this being made public, I think there is a hesitancy that we need to explain. And I would suggest that the hesitancy is based on that there's something that still doesn't fit the math. Even though I'm saying the math does work, but there's something that doesn't fit the way we perceive this should be, which again, certainly not, God forbid, to question those who have, said, Mori Harabi, is among them. But again, he also in practice was hesitant to act on it because of its implication, I think reflects the same idea. That I think that tension there can be explained that way, that theoretically it's true, but theoretically it all fits into the model of Mechila that exists by Kibbutz Av Ve'Em. But to explain the cultural tendency to not invoke that, I think has to do with its larger impact. Just as Rav Asher said that assume Mechila would have a disproportionate cultural impact, even though that also technically should work.
I don't disagree with what you're saying either, but I'm just pointing out, I think this comes as a shock to people. But and I guess the question is,
it does come as a shock. That's what we're explaining. Why is this such a shock? Why does no one know about this? Because it could be easily disseminated if it was,
Okay. The question is, sometimes, cultures change and what's, expressed in one way. And people like to look for heterim sometimes, to go to weddings. And maybe this heter is a little bit easier than the one, I'll serve some wine or something, which is, whatever. But anyways, thank you. That's a fascinating, very important point. And as you say, the emotions, and it affects, you know, one time or another, pretty much everybody. And whatever, we should be zocha to go to weddings and happy occasions and celebrate happy things. And I want to thank you for the series, your insight, and all the classes. And thank you very much. And a pleasure learning with you. And you should be well, and we should all be well. To our next year tomorrow is Rabbi Schwartz, continuing his series. Yeah, yep. Bye, Rabbi Feldman. Thank you very much. You're very busy. Thank you don't have so to much. Stay for the announcements.
Thanks so much to everyone for coming. Thank you. Have a wonderful summer.
Thank you. Tomorrow morning, Rabbi Schwartz, Ari Schwartz, his series on religious Zionism. Tomorrow he's talking about animal sacrifices, reinstitutions. I don't know if you want to go on the Temple Mount, but whatever, we'll leave the politics aside, the halacha of the reinstitution of animal sacrifices. I believe that's his topic tomorrow. Tomorrow night, Mark Shapiro, class 49, in his series on his correspondence with rabbinic figures. He probably just has like two, maybe three classes left in that series. And then we'll be starting up a few new series next week. We'll keep you posted. Wednesday, Marty election, and the Haftorah and Parsha and Pirkei Avot, that's all continuing this week. And we'll keep you posted with our new series. Okay. Wish everybody a wonderful day, and everybody should be well. Thank you very much. Shavua Tov, everybody. Okay. Bye-bye.